Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 7 years ago, when President Bill Clinton passed his landmark welfare reform, the change was considered so dramatic that the very word welfare was supposed to fade away, replaced by terms like personal responsibility and work opportunity. More to the point, the change was supposed to end decades of dependence and usher in a new era of dignity. The dignity of a job, a paycheck, not a welfare check. Well, some of the language doesn't go away that easily. We still talk about it as welfare reform. And the Bush administration likes the idea so much that it's proposing changes that would strengthen the work requirements and time limits in the current law. So today we're looking at the reform and the proposed changes, not in the warm economic glow of the 1990s, but in the harsher, colder light of the current recession. Supporters of the reform say that tough times still require tough love when it comes to economic assistance. Others worry that toughening up welfare rules now may backfire, particularly with state budgets under such stress. So, Connection listeners, what do you think? Can welfare reform weather a weak economy without stranding people who need help? Or should the government be bending the rules in tough economic times? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This hour, we'll be talking with a couple of people pondering these very questions. We want to start, though, with someone who's working hands-on with welfare reform and the people who need it. Frank Rocky is in Greenfield, Massachusetts. He's a caseworker with the Department of Transitional Assistance there. Hello, Frank.
Hello.
How are things with the economy in Greenfield?
Well, the economy in Greenfield isn't doing that well. We're an old tool town, and we've lost a lot of our companies that need to. I guess the service economy is going to have to pick it up.
And how are you seeing that reflected in your caseload?
That's really not making too much of a difference as far as the caseload and the number of people applying. There's a steady number of people applying. I don't think it's increased much dramatically lately.
So give us the two perspectives here, the good news and the bad news. Give us an example of how you see welfare reform working today to, you know, keep somebody at a job or to keep somebody off the dole.
Well, today, as far as right now, welfare reform isn't working. Welfare reform today is dead in the water from a worker's perspective. One of the problems is that welfare reform requires a great deal of face time between the worker and the client in order to explain all of the various options available to the client. Normally, we would have a client that's work required come in and see us every couple of months. Due to the cutbacks, due to the budget cutbacks, due to the layoffs of workers, we're really unable to see the clients on the basis we need to see. We can spend very little time as far as helping the clients get off welfare.
Yeah.
We're spending all our time just trying to determine eligibility and get clients on welfare. They have just eliminated the Employment Service Program, which was one of the few programs we had to try to send our clients to the various agencies that could help them. That's just been totally eliminated by the department. So even though welfare reform still exists on paper, as far as the workers go, we're very frustrated. It's dead in the water.
Those state programs, if I understand them correctly, Frank, were supposed to be the carrots that went along with the stick, no?
Yes. Right now, the stick is still here, but the carrots are gone.
This is Massachusetts simply saying that we can't afford the job training or the child care or however that money is funneled to the people?
I think this is just really very poor planning on the part of the people that have developed welfare reform and that have been overseeing welfare reform on an ongoing basis. They've been listening to either the client organizations, which are they're very nice people, but they have an agenda, or they've been listening to the politicians on the right, and they have an agenda. They haven't been speaking to the workers and supervisors in the field to find out how to make the system work better.
Frank, back up a bit for us, because in the late 1990s, most reports about welfare reform were pretty positive, that people were actually getting jobs and staying at work rather than staying at home.
Well, that's right. Back at that time, we had fairly low caseloads. So we were able to see clients on an ongoing basis. Clients who were work required, those clients would be coming into our office every 2 to 3 months. We would be discussing their progress, letting them know of various new job opportunities, new training opportunities, short-term training opportunities, and working with them very intensively. That process stopped about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, when the new Beacon computer system came in. That took up so much of our time. It's a very non-functioning computer system, really. That kept us from really being able to do the kind of work we needed to do with our clients. And during the last year and a half, the massive number of retirements and the massive number of layoffs of our workers have made it so that we really just can't see the clients face-to-face and give them the attention they have to have. Most clients, they're on assistance and they're off within a few months. They've been working for a long period of time. They know the roles, how to get a job, how to interview. But there's quite a few clients that don't have the tools they need to know how to make it through the maze of welfare and get the training and get off. Those are the clients we need to work with, and those are the clients we don't have the time to work with. And unfortunately, they're staying on welfare for much longer than they want to right now because of the cutbacks and the other problems with the system.
Frank, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
A pleasure talking. Thank you very much. And while I have you on the phone, if I could just invite Commissioner Wagner and Governor Romney to come down and spend a day at the Greenfield DTA office, not make it a photo op, but actually come down here, sit here, talk with us, and listen to clients for the day, and maybe they'll get a hand on how really to make welfare reform work.
You're in luck, Frank. They are regular listeners to the
Connection.
All right. Thanks for being with us. Frank Rothy is in Greenfield, Massachusetts. He's a caseworker with the Department of Transition Assistance there. Now joining us from Washington is Jason Turner. In the 1990s, Jason designed Wisconsin Works. That's the state's welfare reform program there that was seen by so many as a model. He was also welfare commissioner in New York City under Giuliani. He's currently the executive director of the Center for Self-Sufficiency in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's a conservative research organization. And we're also joined by Sharon Parrott. She is the director of the Welfare Reform Division of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. It's a liberal research organization in Washington. Thanks, both of you, for coming in.
Thank you.
Jason, let me start with you, if I can, because you listen to Frank and know these issues well when he talks about the program being dead in the water. What are you hearing?
What I'm hearing him say is that his computer system is taking up too much of his time. And that's a management issue. Let me back up by saying in Massachusetts, the proportion of people on welfare in 1996 before the reforms as compared to now is down about 60%. So if the caseworker in Greenfield is in a typical Massachusetts town, they have 60% fewer people to try and help move to employment. At the same time, the system that was created in 1966 by the Republican Congress block granted the amount of money going to states to help people. So essentially, he has the same amount of money, or the state does, now as it did in 1996, although they have 60% fewer people. What's really happening is lots of states are moving money out of the block grant and to pay for other things, which is okay. And they should do so because there's so many fewer people on welfare. The real problem is a management issue. It's not a funding issue.
And Sharon, is that the way you hear it as well?
Well, it's interesting. We've been looking at what states have been doing around the country. And states around the country are starting to cut back on programs. They're starting to cut back on programs for sort of two big reasons. One is the very significant fiscal crisis that states themselves have found themselves in, which is leading them to reduce some of the state funding that has gone into programs for low-income families. The other is that for the first couple of years after the 96 law was passed, states actually spent a little bit less than they were getting each year from the federal government in welfare funding. And so that built up some unspent money. Sometimes it's called reserves. Over the last few years, they've been drawing on those reserves to really supplement the amount of money they get annually from the federal government. And it's been quite significant. just last year, states spent about $1.6 billion more than they actually get from the federal government for that year by drawing on these unspent money. That's all very technical, but the reality is that those unspent funds have pretty much been diminished. They've been exhausted. States have spent them on a number of programs for low-income families, and they no longer have those resources. So, in fact, states, including Massachusetts, but really a broad array of states, are starting to cut back on programs. Some states, like Massachusetts, have cut back on the kinds of programs that help people move from welfare to work. A lot of states, though, have had to cut back on programs that actually serve working poor families, not receiving welfare. Kansas, Montana, Nebraska, New Mexico, the list goes on and on of the states that are actually having to pare back the amount of help they're giving, again, to working families not getting welfare. And typically what they're doing is being less helpful in providing help to pay for child care.
Let me just stop you there if I can, Sharon, because I think we perhaps need to just step back a bit. And Jason, if I can get you to start on this. Back in 96, when the welfare reform was passed, there were skeptics and critics. And in the years after that, people raised their eyebrows and thought, wow, this is working better than we thought. And our question today is, will it continue to succeed in a failing economy? What's your sort of straight out view of that?
Well, first of all, if you have a weaker economy, then it's all the more important, not less important, that you have a good and strong welfare reform that moves people as quickly as possible into employment, not going back to the old welfare system.
Right.
I mean, for instance, if let's suppose
that's, you're that assumes there are jobs for them to go to.
It assumes there's jobs for them to go to, but if there's no employment at the moment for somebody,
right,
then the answer is not to have them sit around and watch television until such time as the economy improves, but to keep them active, to keep them engaged in a work activity that keeps their work habits and skills in good repair so that as soon as there's an opening in the economy, they can move right into it. The idea that what we have to do is retreat from the kinds of reforms that were successful because there may not be a job for everyone right away is nonsense.
Won't it become more expensive, though, if there are fewer people who are able to find employment with an employer and more people who are, you know, doing their work time in hospitals and other places where they're not getting compensated?
Well, you chose to lead off the program with a discussion of budgets. And having run the New York City welfare system for Mayor Giuliani for 4 years, I can tell you that money is not primarily or even secondarily the central issue in trying to get people to move to work. It's a factor, but it's not a main factor. The main thing that you need to try and be successful in welfare to work programs is to have a system where when people walk in the door, they're offered an immediate employment position. And then if they can't find one right away, even before they go on welfare, then you help them find a work experience position and use other training and education while they're working to create what we call a simulated work week. These kinds of things require some funds, and they require some child care funds. But the way you pay for that is by having people move into employment and close their welfare case, and then you free up the money that used to be spent on cash, and you use it for services.
All right, Sharon, I'm going to turn to you when we come back after the break. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. And we're looking at the state of welfare reform and the prospect of a falling economy and whether or not there's a collision lying ahead. What's your view on that? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR News.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about welfare reform in changing times. With us on the program, Jason Turner. He's Executive Director of the Center for Self-Sufficiency in Milwaukee. And Sharon Parrott, Director of the Welfare Reform Division of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And Sharon, if I can turn to you, Jason is saying, if I understand what he's saying correctly, that this is precisely the time when the qualities of welfare reform come to the fore in terms of its adaptability and to you know, changing work environments for people, even in tough economic times. We're also looking at some changes being proposed by the Bush administration. Are you optimistic about what's ahead?
Well, let me take a step back. I think that it is exactly right that when the economy is down, that doesn't mean that you don't do anything to help people prepare for work and find jobs. I think, and in fact, I don't think you would find very many people that would say that when the economy is down, we shouldn't do anything to help people get ready for work, find jobs, upgrade their skills,
right.
Really take the opportunity, might not be a great opportunity, but to take and move forward towards self-sufficiency. So I would say that's exactly right. I would say, though, that it does cost resources. If it didn't cost resources, we wouldn't see states cutting back. And so we have to be realistic about what things cost. We have to balance our goal to help people prepare for and move to work with the resources we're willing to put into that endeavor. And so within reauthorization, and that's the legislative kind of second look at the welfare law to extend it and continue it and make any changes that the Congress and the president would like to make to the law, what has to be really carefully considered is what expectations do we want to put on states? What expectations do we want to put on parents? And what do those expectations cost? And are the resources there? And at what trade-off? And those are important questions. I don't think there's anyone. I've met with Democrats and Republicans all over the Hill. And I don't think there's anyone that isn't firmly committed to a welfare system that requires people to participate in work activities that help them find jobs and that move people into work as quickly as possible. I think that I think that is a very broadly held view, both on Capitol Hill and among the public. And so I think the question really is all about details, but the details really matter. They matter with respect to what's going on right now on the ground and what states are trying to do, which is most states are really trying to continue to help people move to work. And at the same time, they are also trying to make sure that they can help working families not on welfare so that those families don't lose their jobs and come back onto mm-hmm. welfare. And so there are a number of competing priorities that all need to be balanced with a realistic assessment of resources.
All right. Now, Jason, you can say I'm obsessed with the money side of this, but Sharon is saying that the amount of money in the system is an essential issue here when you know, we're looking at announcements from Washington State and from Maryland, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, where child care money for welfare recipients is either on a wait list or it is being cut back. Those are real issues that are going to affect folks who are trying to take advantage of the system, whether it's to go to school or to work in a hospital or to get a job, right?
Yeah, I would say you are obsessed with money, or the, not you personally, but many on the left of center are. But you have to actually run a program to see what costs what and what really helps. One of the most effective things you do when you're running a welfare program is meet people at the front door. You know, there's the front door and the back door. The back door is helping people get off once they're on, mm-hmm. and meeting them at the front door is even more critical. You say, when they're applying for welfare, we want you to look for work while you're applying for welfare, even before you get on welfare. And if you do that, you find about half of the people who apply for welfare end up not needing it. Secondly, many of the things that we do to help people move off of welfare don't cost much. For instance, in New York, we had an extensive program where people would go into work settings, for instance, in nonprofits, working in a hospital, working at a nonprofit doing filing or answering the phones that allowed them to practice work while giving something back to the community. But those kinds of programs, which were so helpful, actually didn't cost anything except for childcare. So there will always be, and I've run a large bureaucracy, the bureaucracy will always say they don't have enough money. But the real question is, what are they doing with the money that they have?
I just think it's really important, though, to take a step back and recognize that we do have states that are making pretty significant cuts, and that to say that things don't cost money sort of does fly in the face of what states' experience has been. If things didn't cost money, they wouldn't be needing to cut back programs. And in fact, the Congressional Budget Office has said that meeting the increased work requirements under the Bush administration welfare plan as passed by the House earlier this year would cost states an additional $8 to $11 billion over the next 5 years.
But Sharon, if now, I can interrupt, you will agree that the caseloads are down 60% since 1996, and you will agree that currently the same amount of money is being dedicated to welfare as in 1996 under the block grant. So you'll probably agree with me that per welfare recipient, we have right now more than twice as much money. And you're saying the real problem is we don't have enough money. When are we going to get to the point where we say it's the program design and it's the expectations that we impose on welfare recipients to move to work and how we help guide them that's the real issue, not how much more money we have?
I do want to respond. It is true that caseloads are down. There's no question about that. What have states done with the resources freed up when caseloads fell? What they did with those resources were to invest in very important kinds of help for working families not on welfare. And in fact, we actually had what I sometimes talk of as a very positive feedback loop. Caseloads went down. States had resources freed up.
Sharon, can you give me an example of what you're talking about there? You're saying they took some of that money and gave it to families that were already working that weren't on welfare. Where was that
money? What they really did was they poured a tremendous amount of money into child care so that when families left welfare, they had child care help. And even families that were never on welfare but were poor, were struggling to make ends meet, had help with child care. In fact, 20% of welfare block grant dollars last year went not to providing cash assistance to people on welfare, but to giving people help paying for child care so that they could keep those jobs and make ends meet for their family. That makes work pay. It's good for children to be in quality child care settings. And it's good for families because when you're working at $7 or $8 an hour, which is what the typical former welfare recipient earns, paying hundreds of dollars each month for childcare can be very daunting. And in fact, they can't do it without help. And if they can't do it, then children aren't in the high quality childcare settings that we know now, increasingly from research, benefit children enormously. So it is, in fact, often the case that it costs more money to provide a family with two young children with help paying for child care for those two children while the mother works than it is to provide them a very small cash benefit. I think most people would agree that it is good for everyone to help them pay for child care and have that mother working. The family's better off, the mother's working, the children see a parent who works, and the children are in quality child care. But it doesn't
mean
that it's cheaper.
Let me step in here because I want to try and get to our callers if I can. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Somerville, Massachusetts now. Anna's joining us. Hello, Anna.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, my point is simply I consider welfare reform to be a great failure. And the reason why I feel that way is because it's pretty much been defined, its success has been defined as having people off of the welfare rolls. But it hasn't, you don't know what has happened to them. And I happen to know personally what has happened to some of these people who went from welfare to work. They are living in abject poverty, and their children are suffering. And this whole thing seems to me to be a colossal bad joke.
Are you saying, Anna, that someone who's working,
yes,
and raising kids is in worse shape than they were when they were
absolutely
at home taking a welfare check?
Here. Right. That's exactly right. And I mean, I wish we were as tough on corporations as we were on welfare recipients.
Okay, let's try and keep it on this issue here.
Okay,
Jason, can I get you to respond to what Anna's saying?
Yes, I mean, I think it's ludicrous to say that somebody's better off staying at home on welfare. First of all, they're going to remain poor, since the only way to get out of poverty is to go to work. And secondly, and more importantly, work is not just a way for families to have more income, although that's also true, but it's a way for them to give something back to society, to become part of what we all do every day to help one another. And if you want to really be a role model for your child, you'll have to enter the labor force.
Jason, help me out, though, with the complaint that I've heard from Anna and from other people about these low-paying jobs and childcare responsibilities and transportation. That, just to take an example, someone could be as boxed in to a, you know, a stocking job paying $6.50 an hour as they were boxed in on welfare, that there's no way up or out of that.
Well, let's take the stocking job that you gave an example of that pays, in your example, $6.50 an hour. If you're a single mother and you've got three children and you take that stocking job that you described and you add to it the earned income tax credit, which you're eligible for, which is a payment from the government to help support low-wage workers,
right,
together your income in that example will be $13,000 from wages for a full-time job plus another $4,000 from the earned income tax credit. That's $17,000 after taxes. That puts this example, single mom and three kids, out of poverty. And furthermore, it's the only way she's going to get out of poverty. The problem that we have right now with poverty is not that there's insufficient supports for low-wage working families. The example I gave just shows that. It's the fact that for all poor families with children, the median hours that adults actually are in the labor force runs from between 650 and 1,000 hours a year.
That's a work week of what? Break that down for me.
Well, there's 2,000 hours in 40 hours a week times 50 weeks a year. That's the full-time, full year. The average poor head of household with children only works between 650 and 1,000 hours, meaning between 35 and 50% of the full-time annual year. If we were to get them to work at the full-time for 2,000 hours or 1,800 hours even, we would reduce the poverty rate by 72%. That's the answer. It's not to worry about more welfare budgets for the state government or
now you're taking us things. To the changes that the Bush administration is proposing, that there be an encouragement to go to a greater, a longer working week, right?
Well, I'm making a distinction here between what the Bush administration is proposing will lead to permanent private full-time employment, yes. What I'm saying right now is that the goal, that should be the goal, because the private employment by poor heads of household is so low right now, and we should be focused on what we can do in that regard.
All right. You're listening just a second, Sharon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I want to go to Newport News, Virginia. Neil's been waiting on the line. Neil, go ahead.
Hi, yes, okay. I think it's admirable, first of all, to try to get people that were on welfare into the workforce instead of just, as the saying goes, watching TV. But with the rough economy we have now, you know, its employment is a sort of an up-and-down situation, and these low-paying people can't really afford to save. And Time magazine recently had an article about homeless people and how some of them are people who had jobs, very low paying, and then they lost their jobs. So what we really need is things to pick up for people who already have these skills. I mean, of course, it's better to have skills, but even the people with skills are getting laid off, and they're in trouble. And the lower their pay is to begin with, the harder it is.
So what are you saying should change, Neil?
Well, I'm not sure exactly how to do it, but we can't just think of it as going out of welfare as being like taking a child and turning him or her into like a grown-up, sort of like, and saying, okay, now you have, everything's going to be okay, and you can be just left cast adrift, because these people obviously are hurting. I mean, we hear about their stories, and I'm not sure about the answers, but people should acknowledge that you can't just transform somebody into some sort of a new category of, you know, working person and expect everything to be okay just because of that.
All right, let me turn to Sharon. Sharon, I interrupted you a couple of minutes ago.
Well, I think it's important for listeners to realize that we actually have a lot of information about what happens when people leave welfare. When people leave welfare, they tend to work. Their average hours of work are actually between 30 and 40 hours. That's people who have left welfare and found jobs. And I think that it is true that in this country, it will be very difficult, actually impossible, to rise out of poverty without significant hours of work in the paid labor force. I don't think there's a lot of argument about that. I think the outstanding questions are how best to make sure that when people are working in low-wage jobs, we help them. We help them both make ends meet in the short term and move up in the labor force so that over time their earnings do rise.
But I thought that the welfare reform was designed to allow that kind of individual attention.
Well, currently, states actually have a lot of flexibility. And the interesting thing is that states around the country have really identified two big challenges that they are working, I would say, pretty hard to think creatively about how to tackle. One is, how do we help people get better jobs at the beginning and give them training while they're in jobs so that they move to better jobs? And so you see a number of states that have started to make more use of community college and short-term training that's very occupational specific to try and get people a little bit better job, a little bit more stability. So that's one piece of the puzzle. The other piece of the other big challenge that I think a lot of states have recognized is that there are a group of families that aren't finding jobs, that do have serious problems, mental health problems, disability, substance abuse. That doesn't mean we should ignore those families. That doesn't mean that those families don't want to work. But it does mean that they may need a different set of help in order to get a job. And so you also have a number of states, very diverse states, Maine and Tennessee, for example, that have really tried to think about, when we have a person that walks through our door and they have a serious disability or they have a serious substance abuse problem or they can't read, very big issue in a number of states, how can we help them individually tailor a set of activities and requirements around those families and help them move forward? And the reality is that a lot of states around the country, very diverse states, have tried to really think about, when somebody walks through the door, and Jason's exactly right, when someone walks through the door, that's a very important time to think about how can we best help that family.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the promise of welfare reform and the varying treatment that people are getting in different states, in different state programs, and in different situations around the country. We'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is...
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, these are difficult economic times. Some statistics are indicating that as many as 2 million jobs have been lost in the economy over the past couple of years. So, is this a time when the versatility of welfare reform introduced 7 years ago is supposed to show up and shine? Or do the economic circumstances demand some kind of adjustment here in welfare reform, either in money or the approach? We'd like to hear from you. We'll start in Spokane, Washington. Chris is with us on the phone. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Good. Love the show. I'm a social worker. I work as a mental health counselor. About 85% of my caseload is with folks on public assistance, including a lot of folks on Work First who have been directed to me to deal with some issues of self-esteem, depression, domestic violence, what have you, as part of their program to get back into the workforce. And my concern is that we tend to look at Work First or welfare reform almost in isolation and not on a systemic level. For example, here in Spokane, bus lines were recently consolidated due to cutbacks, drastic cutbacks in funding for public transportation. Now, that's a funding source that's not from welfare, but it affects folks on welfare.
Well, you mean it's more expensive to ride the bus in Spokane?
It's more expensive, and bus lines have been cut or eliminated. So, for example, there was a news report in our newspaper a while ago that a woman who took a second shift job in order to get a she was someone who'd been on welfare, got in the workforce, second shift job. She needed the shift differential to make ends meet. She had to leave that job because the late night bus she relied on to get home was eliminated. Also, there is not enough daycare in Spokane, even if you can pay for it. And, you know,
Chris, let me just ask you about the bus line, though, because I think it's a good example. I mean, I think that the people who are behind welfare reform could make an argument that one of the features of it is that it is moving responsibility for decision making to a state level instead of having it come from Washington. And better that somebody in Washington look at the transportation difficulties of someone in Spokane than someone in D.C. looking at it. Wouldn't they be right there?
I think there's certainly a good argument there, but again, we're looking at things systemically, not just in terms of the issue of welfare itself or block grants for welfare. It's how does that money or those resources dovetail with daycare, transportation, adequate medical care, waiting lists to get into programs mm-hmm. because of funding cutbacks. You know, if you want to get into – hi, Andrew – my son's here trying to give me a screwdriver. If you're trying to get into mental health counseling, for example, to deal with issues that might prevent you from getting a job or sustaining a job if you find one, it's a 2-month waiting list.
So what do you think should change then, Chris?
Well, you know, we keep talking about this great euphemism called resources. I think we need more resources, but beyond that, we need to have some very public and broad discussions about what we want to be as a society. If we want these people in work, and I think that's a good thing. The folks I work with who get in the workforce, by and large, seem to do well and have a lot of pride and self-esteem.
Right.
We need to look at providing folks all the total package, and what does it mean for us as a society to want to do that?
I want to turn, if I can, to Jason Turner on this, because, Jason, you'll know from your time with, you know, directly involved in the Wisconsin Works program in New York City, that you can devise the most carefully thought out program and then find out that the change in a bus schedule can mess the whole thing up. The what Chris is describing here, I mean, is there a way of overcoming the fact that no matter what you try and think out and plan out, there'll be these other factors which need to be taken into account? Jason, are you there? No, we seem to have...
Hear me?
Oh, yeah,
can
there you
hear
are.
Me?
Yeah, I hear
okay.
you now. Go ahead.
Yes, I think your caller, who was a social worker, has an orientation which we see in government, which I don't necessarily think is the best approach for helping solve problems. He gave all of these examples of things that are what we sometimes call barriers to people moving to work.
Right.
Depression, domestic violence, self-esteem, and the buses. Well, let's take the first three, depression, domestic violence, and self-esteem. You can't be talked out of those by a social worker. Those things, the only way to attack depression, self-esteem, and even to a degree domestic violence is to get in the labor force where you're meeting other people, you're proactive, you're doing something, you're bringing home money. Those are the ways to get at those kinds of issues. But oftentimes, government workers tend to think that they have to, quote, fix the person before any expectations can be asked. And the bus example is so unbelievably small. All of us have to get to work in the morning. The difference between people that go to work every day and those who don't is that people that go to work every day get there at any cost, and they find ways to get it done. Sure, we can help with government, but saying that the bus line was disconnected, therefore this person's life was thrown into... I mean, this is the kind of mindset, I think, that prevents us from success rather than helping people take control of their own lives and helping move them into responsibility.
You know, I don't think that's what the caller at all was saying. I don't think the caller was saying because a bus line changes, nobody should ever have to go to work. But I think what you do have to do is you have to look at the situation and the circumstances facing people and help them, empower them to find a way out of their problem. The difference between people who go to work every day and a lot of people who don't is, A, the people who go to work every day have jobs, and B, a whole lot of them earn enough to have cars. And so you know what? It's easier. Now, that doesn't mean that people that work in low-wage jobs don't find ways to get to work. Of course they do. And it doesn't mean that if you're not going to have a high-wage job, you shouldn't work at all. What it does mean is how can we best use resources and community institutions to help people get to work? How can we support them and empower them to get to work? And that means when the bus line changes, everyone doesn't throw up their hands. And I don't think the caller was suggesting that you throw up your hands and say, oh my gosh, you certainly can't work, just go back on welfare. But, you know, maybe, and in fact, a number of states have done this, it's worth some resources to help families in places without reliable public transportation get low-cost loans and grants to buy cars, because maybe that's necessary sometimes.
Well, that's a management solution, Sharon, which can be a good one. What I object to is the notion that, again, this is a budget issue, that the bus lines were cut. So how can we expect welfare reform really to work when the bus lines are cut? Look, we have to expect people who are on welfare now that are able-bodied to take responsibility for finding and going to work. And we can support them in that, but we can't take over their responsibility or take over all of the things that they need to do to put themselves in a position to go to work.
Is the caller still there?
No, Chris is gone.
No. Because I'd be very interested. I don't think that a social worker that helps people with mental health problems in order for them to go to work would really be suggesting that he wants to take over anybody's life and that people can't work. In fact, the caller was very clear that the people he sees and has helped that have gotten jobs have really benefited from those jobs. So I think the question is about an orientation to helping people get to work. Just one quick thing. Jason talked earlier about a family that made $17,000 with the combination of her wages and some other supports. And isn't that great? And that is great. But the reality is, if she has three young children that need childcare, her childcare bill could easily be conservatively $15,000 a year. And even if only two children need childcare, it's $10,000 a year. It's not that anyone's saying the mother shouldn't work, but it is about recognizing that it really does cost $10,000 at least to put two children in even moderately quality childcare programs.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Newton, Massachusetts. Now Karen's with us. Hello, Karen.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
You'll have to forgive me if I get a little angry about the subject.
Just be clear for us.
I'm a former single mother who was not on welfare. I worked. Our life was Dickensian. I was lucky enough to be fairly intelligent and well-read, so I could get a job that paid a little more than minimum wage. And in those days, daycare wasn't quite as expensive as it is now compared to the average wage of a low-wage earner. We still barely made it. Daycare took half of my salary, which wasn't very much, and we had almost nothing. We just barely squeaked by. We had Christmases, you know, with no toys. My son couldn't have anything that wasn't free.
Karen, you're not saying that welfare was a more attractive alternative than that,
right?
You
know, when I look back on it now, maybe my son, you know, could have had something once in a while if we had been on welfare. You know, he broke his wrist once, and I didn't take him to the hospital for a week because I didn't know how I was going to pay for it.
So what's the point you want to make to my guests here, Karen? What's the one thing you're not hearing on this program that you think needs to be said?
Do the math. Figure out what it costs to pay daycare for two kids. I only had one, and that was one of the reasons. Do the math and figure out what it costs if you're making $7, $8 an hour to pay for daycare, which is at minimum $100 a week, for two kids, and still come out with more than, say, $50 a week to live on. Somebody's living in la-la land there. They're just not doing the math. Without subsidized daycare, there's no way that most women who aren't well-educated and very employable can make it.
Karen?
So to have one without the other is just not realistic.
Karen, thank you for your call. Jason, let's go to you.
There's a tremendous amount of new daycare money that's been made available because many people are going to work. And what's happened is as people have gone to work and benefits have gone down, states have reallocated that to child care. Child care does run for a young child $100 a week. It can run more than that. And it can equal an amount of money that is quite high. Fortunately, we have that money. But the problem, but we have to be sure we keep in our head what we want to try and accomplish. We're not trying to save money here necessarily on every case that closes. What we're trying to do is help families get in a position with supports so that they can provide for themselves and their children and become role models and productive members of society. That's our goal.
I think it's very important to understand that there has been a tremendous increase in the amount of money available for childcare. I think it's one of the reasons that we have seen people be able to leave welfare and go to work. At the same time, we're still in a situation where only 1 in 7 low-income children eligible for child care help gets that help. There are children across this country on waiting lists or who are told that they can't, that there's no point in applying because there's simply no child care subsidies left. And we need to think about as we allocate resources what that means if we don't have child care out there for every low-income child that needs it.
Well, you know, Sharon, when I ran the New York City program, we had child care waiting lists, too, when I got there. And what we did is we started calling people in and saying, okay, if you're going to work, we want to provide child care for you, so how much do you need? What we found are that many people had put themselves on 2 or 3 different waiting lists. Some people already had child care but were looking for other kinds of child care. Some people who needed child care before had put their name on a list, and a year later they were still on the list, but they'd moved out of state.
Are you
and
suggesting,
so on and so on.
Are you suggesting that in states right now, every low-income child that needs help paying for child care can get it? Because it simply isn't true. Right here in the District of Columbia, they had to institute a waiting list for child care because they simply ran out of money. And there are actually many children that just simply applied and were put on a waiting list, and their parents are just in a holding pattern. You know, it's one thing to talk about priorities. It's another to misrepresent the reality that there are people out there that aren't getting the help they need, and there are people out there that are piecing together child care arrangements that, frankly, parents aren't comfortable with, they aren't high quality, and while their parent may be able to work, the child isn't in the kind of environment that I think most people think children should be in.
All parents are eligible for the dependent child care tax credit, which at income levels is refundable, meaning they get some of the money back in their if they are not paying tax credit taxes. That's for lower middle income families best.
Jason,
and
I'm
and
sorry.
Worth a fraction of the total.
I've got to interrupt you, folks. We're out of time. It sounds like we need to spend another hour or more on child care alone. So, Jason Turner, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Jason directed Wisconsin's Welfare Reform Program. He's currently Executive Director of the Center for Self-Sufficiency in Milwaukee. And Sharon Parrott, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Sharon's Director of the Welfare Reform Division of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington. We talked earlier with Frank Rocky, a caseworker in Greenfield, Massachusetts. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. Coming up next in the second hour of The Connection with Dick Gordon.